Welcome to the Rise Up Good Witch podcast, a radical approach to herbalism, self-care, and the tarot. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 52nd episode of the Rise Up Good Witch podcast. This is Karina. I'm so honored today to share this conversation with amazing anti-oppression consultant and boundary work educator, Mackenzie Mack. And I'm feeling pretty energized in general today. It's May 2nd, the day after Beltane and May Day, which felt really invigorating. I made a love spell potion with some champagne and herbs and strawberries. And I made an essence of Venus and was able to share that with the folks that I share land with here in the Mojave Desert. And I feel like some portals are opening up. Like I always say, I think we have to go to our deepest fears and our worries and our shadow self in order to emerge into the hopefulness, into the light. And that's kind of what Beltane felt to me this year. But again, there is that grief that exists underneath it all. And I wanted to start this episode differently. I felt called to. I've never pulled a card, I don't think, on any episode. I don't think I've ever done a live reading. But I got the message that it was something that I should do. So I'm going to go ahead and shuffle the cards and pull one of the cards out. So I'm really holding space for our growth in Beltane. And yesterday on Beltane, the spread that I got with Mary Evans Spirit Speak deck was the Page of Cups, Justice, and the High Priestess, which to me was an incredibly applicable message for times such as what we are going through. Three cards just fell out as I was shuffling, so I'm going to see what they were. Okay, we have the Empress, the King of Swords, and the Three of Cups. So again, it's funny because I don't usually like to do two spreads 2 days in a row. I think sometimes when we try to call upon our guides too frequently, messages can become diluted, or we can show our spirit guides that we're not listening and we're not paying attention. So I kind of tend to go to the less is more realm. But the Empress and the Three of Cups together, along with the King of Swords, again, it does feel very validating. And the fact that these cards fell out of the deck, the Empress first, then the King of Swords, and then the Three of Cups. What I see for this is that we're creating kind of like a circle, kind of like the serpent swallowing its own tail. And the idea of this is like this ability to receive and create systems of mutual aid and the power that that has in whatever the opposite of trickling up, like not trickling down like free market capitalism lied to us and told us it would do, but more of an idea of spreading upwards. So kind of like the King of Swords is the energy that we are embodying, but not through any oppressive hierarchical systems. Instead, it's through a celebration of one another and an ability to receive support. Something that's been coming through a lot is how much living in an individualistic society is damaging us as a collective. That's not a new thing. I feel like that's been a cornerstone of my work, but the energies of the Empress with the King of Swords, with the Three of Cups, is such a celebration of power and a new form of empowerment. And that feels like it really goes in conjunction with the Page of Cups, Justice, and the High Priestess that I pulled yesterday and wrote about on Instagram. It feels like we're relearning power structures. There aren't really any big challenges here except the ones that we already know about. It almost feels like this steam is rising. Something is rising from the surface, and it's beautiful, and it reminds me of lilies and the way that lilies are these beautiful flowers, and the flower essence meanings are often about reclaiming and healing our sexuality, and that's also very related to Beltane. And that is revolutionary when we think about the fact that we live in a rape culture. So lots of Empress energy, lots of Three of Cups celebration. Three of Cups is a very Beltane related card, I think, because again, it's love and it's a celebration of love. And there isn't really in the Three of Cups like a love that we think of as being romantic. It's a community love. It's solidarity. And obviously the King of Swords is a card that can go either way. I often think about it as being potentially very intimidating depending on where it's placed in a spread. But the fact that it comes between the Empress and the Three of Cups is like a reclamation of power. So I'm excited about these three cards falling out of the deck, and I don't think that it's a mistake. So today's conversation is with Mackenzie Mack. I've been following Mackenzie's work for probably about a year, and I've also been a patron of theirs because I find their offerings and their insights that they share on Instagram really, really insightful. And after having this conversation with them, as I say in the conversation, my respect for their work and just my love of all they represent in this world and all that they share in this conversation has expanded so much. So I really recommend checking out Mackenzie's work, join their Patreon, follow them on Instagram, think about signing up for one of their classes. I know they offer some from time to time. Obviously, we're living in totally different times. We're living in pandemic times, and face-to-face introductions and classes and work is kind of shifting. It's not really what it used to be. So I don't know what to say about that. It's something that I've been deeply processing, but one thing I feel is really creating and having the ability to listen. One of the forgotten aspects of the King of Swords, I think, is its ability to listen. The King of Swords and all kings represent this powerful energy of igniting the flame of a new area of life. So it feels like the King of Swords here also reflects back on that idea of listening and holding space and growing through understanding one another's stories. So yeah, definitely check out Mackenzie Mack's work. I am so honored that they agreed to be on the show. If you enjoy this podcast and you want to help support the work, you can go to www.patreon.com/riseupgoodwitch. Big, huge shout out to all my patrons who have stuck around during this really difficult and uncertain economic time where a lot of us are in so much grief and fear and trauma. I'm so blessed and lucky that so many of you have stuck around and that there's even been new folks showing up in the last month. So if you would like to be a part of the Patreon community, for as low as $2, you can help support the work. And for as low as $5, you get access to a ton of extra content, including a monthly e-zine and a monthly live full moon reading, which is going to happen in just a couple days for the full moon in Scorpio. And I have some exciting spells and things and offerings that I'm preparing now that I'm going to announce on that video to patrons. So I'm really excited about it. Patrons of $5 or more also get a 20% discount in the apothecary and a 25% discount on private tarot readings, which now are all taking place via Skype and FaceTime. So I would love to see you over there. Your support means more than I can say. And you can also, if you're feeling the strain of the times, if it's not in your budget to support the work for $5, you can go to Apple Podcasts or iTunes and you can leave a 5-star review and a rating, and that also really helps this work get out to more people. You can also take a screenshot, share on social media. These things are really important. The thing with podcasts, especially little DIY podcasts like mine, I don't have advertisers. So I only create this content and have gotten the listenership I have from, I guess, from word of mouth and from like my Instagram following. because it's so interesting to me when I connect with listeners, usually on Patreon, and I'm so surprised all these amazing people are finding my work from all over the country and all over the world. And that's really exciting. And I don't really know how everybody finds it, but it's great because there are so many online offerings now. There are so many podcasts, and there's a lot of great ones, and there's a lot of ones that maybe fall flat in certain ways. I'll just say that. But leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts is so helpful, and it makes me feel so happy. I've gotten a couple new ones in the last couple months, and I wanted to read this one. It says, "Love this podcast," from Your Girl B. "I have so much respect for Karina and the gifts she shares with us on this podcast. The conversations are real, heart-centered, enlightening, and all in context of destroying oppressive structures while supporting the ongoing conversation, the ongoing construction of a more liberated, just, and loving world. Karina, as a facilitator, is honest in a way that humbles me every time I listen and hear more of the way they show up and commit themselves to the work. It's so fun to learn along with the podcast and the amazing guests that come to share as well. Thanks for all you do and gratitude for you, Karina." Thanks, Your Girl B. I appreciate you too. And I also love reading these reviews because a lot of times when I read reviews like this, I'm like, yay, people get it, because that's exactly the kind of content I want to be putting out into the world. So leaving a 5-star review, it's totally free. It takes like a second, and writing a review maybe takes a minute. And it's super appreciated and really necessary and needed in these times for independent media. One other announcement is that this month I'm doing a fundraiser, kind of, I guess you would say. 10% of my apothecary sales are going to go to National Bailout, which bails out Black mamas who were incarcerated for nonviolent offenses. And with Mother's Day coming up, this is a really important time to support their work. We have to be orienting our healing work towards the destruction of the prison industrial complex and other institutions that are upholding white supremacy, hierarchy, class warfare, etc. So anything you buy from the shop, anything in the apothecary that you buy, 10% will go to National Bailout. So I'll have a link in the show notes. And I really hope you enjoy this episode and that you're well and you're taking care of yourself and that your family's well and your communities are well. And I'm sending you lots of love and just trying to create as much magic as I can to spread outwards like the King of Swords. To the world, to others, to hold space for growth. I'm here today with Mackenzie Mack. Mackenzie, welcome to the Rise Up Good Witch podcast. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so for people that aren't aware of your work and what you do, do you want to give us a little bit of background and how you identify and what work you're doing?
Sure. So again, my name is Mackenzie Mack. Most folks know me as Mackenzie Mack across my social media platforms. Other folks also call me Bunny, which is also, you know, if you've never seen me in person, is tattooed on my hand. And I am an anti-oppression consultant, a researcher, a facilitator. I am the founder of a project of a community called Boundary Work, which focuses specifically on helping people to really define, identify, and hold to their boundaries, not only with other people, like in interpersonal relationships, but individually and institutionally. So I've been doing that work for some time, and my pronouns are they, them, theirs.
Awesome. So I'm curious, I really want to hear about, because boundary work, I feel like in general, like people doing work around boundaries is something that's become, in the last couple of years, it feels like it's become kind of like a hot topic, especially in like activist communities and queer social justice oriented communities. Mm-hmm. And I'm really curious to hear about how you got oriented into this work.
Oh my gosh, such a great question. So I have so many stories around how I sort of came into doing anti-oppression work. One that I like to tell most often, or that I've told the most times, was that when I was in high school, I decided that I wanted to be an interpreter. So I thought, you know, I'm gonna be an interpreter for the UN. And it's gonna be an amazing job, and I'll be able to have, like, you know, affect so much change into people's lives by becoming an interpreter translator. So I studied linguistics. I have 2 degrees in linguistics from the University of Chicago. When I graduated, I moved to France and was teaching in, like, really schools are predominantly made up of kids of color. So I taught in about 3 schools in the banlieues of France, which is like areas where they typically will just like send or bustle over poor immigrant families and poor immigrant communities. And when they asked me, you know, where do you want to teach? I said, I want to teach here because I want to teach in a place that's most, in a place that reminds me of where I come from. And I'm from the south side of Chicago and, you know, grew up in a sort of educational system or in a sort of a system where my mom wanted the very best for us, but also had to work with the fact that she didn't have a lot of money. So I was like, you know, send me into this area, send me to the place where people don't want to go. So they sent me there. And it was one of the most incredible experiences of my life because it was one of the first times that I'd ever, because I had traveled abroad before, but this was like one of the first times I'd ever traveled abroad and actually were encountering people that were a lot like me, which is, you know, I think interesting to say when you're talking about being a teacher in a classroom with like your students, but also I was super young at the time. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was like, wow, there's so many sort of, affinity. This feels like an affinity space for me. And there's so many things that I have in common with my students where I know what it's like to be treated like you don't matter by your government. I know what it's like to be erased as like as a black person, right? I know what it's like to be erased as a person of color. And I know what it's like to have people in authority figures who in public, you know, make these commitments, these outward commitments to caring about you and outward commitments to your protection and your safety and your development. Privately sort of break those commitments in ways that show that they haven't worked with their own internalization of whiteness, their own internalization of institutionalized harm. So it changed me a lot, you know, to say the least. It changed me a lot. And I think it's like this, there's this James Baldwin quote where he says something along the lines of, you know, I used to think that I was alone in the world, you know, that my oppression was like my own. And then I started to read and I realized that this was like, you know, something that was way bigger than just my experience. And it made me feel more like, you know, I think the interpreting it very loosely. For me personally, it made me feel more understood. So I started doing more, you know, I actually did reach my goal of becoming an interpreter. So I worked for the state of Illinois and was again working specifically with like the most vulnerable communities of folks whose first language was not English. Mm-hmm. And seeing a lot of these dynamics continue to play out where these families are being treated really poorly by practitioners. And I was the intermediary. So there were a lot of times when people were telling me what my boundaries should be like, well, this is like mm-hmm. our institutional boundary, for example, is that whatever is being interpreted is something that you have to interpret. So if someone is yelling and, you know, they're yelling in their language and you're interpreting, then when you sort of interpret that to the other person, then you should mimic that. And so I found myself in a lot of situations where there was one person who had more power, who was abusing that power and being abusive towards the person that I had been hired to interpret for. And plenty of times when I refused to interpret things, although someone else was telling me this was supposed to be my boundary. But for me, it was like, wait, you're telling me this is supposed to be my boundary, but this goes against my ethics and my principles. I'm not going to allow or be an intermediary for someone to be abusive to another person. It's like, that just won't, like, that doesn't work for me. And I think that that really propelled me into doing more work specifically around boundaries, but through a lens of equity and anti-oppression, through a lens of social justice, because I've played many of those roles within like those interpersonal dynamics and within those institutional dynamics. And I just got to this place where I'm like, you know, when I got to the place where I decided I wasn't going to take anybody's shit anymore and stepped into my calling and stepped into my purpose, it's when I also realized, like, actually, there's a lot of people who I love who I want to be able to be encouraged to take their own path, to take their own journey. I'm not taking people's shit anymore, including taking shit from institutions. And that was the birth of Boundary Work.
I love that. I love that so much. And you're just like bringing up all these thoughts about the way that, yeah, like boundaries that exist within like an institutional setting, like in the context of, you know, bigotry, discrimination, hierarchy, et cetera. Like those aren't the boundary, you know, there's such a focus right now on like personal boundaries within interpersonal relationships, but I think you bring up a really good point about the way that institutional boundaries are actually kind of like social control tools, like tools of oppression. Yeah. Would you like align yourself with that statement? Do you think that's like a good way to explain it?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of times we get, you know, and I wrote about this recently on my Instagram, about how we have a lot of relationship experts now, you know, and I think that stemmed for a lot from the 90s when talk shows were just super, super popular, more popular than they are now, where there was this huge focus on like people's interactions with other people. And then I think that sort of developed even further into like, well, what are our interactions with self, with the self? And both are very important. For me, I work from a framework of sort of understanding oppression as the three I's. So it's the individual level, the interpersonal level, the institutional level. And for all of us who carry marginalized identities, we know that these things are always sort of like working, they're interconnected, right? So you can't like separate one from the other. You can't say, well, you know, I have love for myself, and having love for myself is enough for me to affect change in my world. Because yes, that probably is gonna affect a lot of change when it comes to like your own sort of individual personal dynamics, like with how you view yourself, your perception of self and everything else. And that will have an impact on your relationships. But if we say that if we give ourselves permission to say that we love ourselves, but then when we go to work or we are faced with confronting an institution or a government, we say that we're not worthy of that, right? That's like, there's a major cognitive dissonance in there. Mm. So I do agree with what you're saying is like, how the institution is used as sort of like a tool of control, because the institution can easily take a lot of things away from us that are tangible. And I think in relationships, things can be taken away, you know, and that are really painful, especially our emotional connections, the kind of mental connections and spiritual connections and physical connections that we make with other people. But I think a lot of times, you know, because we're just now getting into this place of thinking more so about our boundaries interpersonally and with each other and with ourselves, mm-hmm. that part of the conversation around how that extends to our relationship to the institution often gets left behind.
Wow, that's so powerful. Thank you for sharing that. And I just kind of wanted you talking about these three tiers of call it again, the three different tiers or levels?
So like just three aspects or three characteristics of oppression.
So would you mind expanding on that a little bit? Because I'm really interested to hear how you work with that framework.
Sure. So on that individual level, so basically I'll start with this sort of a foundational idea is that every single person is internalizes systems of oppression. Right. So it's the idea that when we talk about race, for example, and white supremacy, when some white people in a room hear you say, hey, just so we know every white person is racist, a lot of times they take that very personally, right? Because they're like, wait, no, but I'm not, I'm a good person, you know? Like, I care about people of color, and I, you know, am not a, I don't, you know, basically put Confederate flags up in my lawn or anything else. Why do you think that I'm a bad person? But it's sort of working from this premise of like, no, but please understand that you benefit from this system, but we all internalize it, right? Which is why you can have folks that are Black, for example, who will say very anti-Black things, or you can have folks that are Asian who say things that really are very like anti-Asian, that are very like, you know, it's clear that they've internalized a lot of whiteness, a lot of white supremacy around their own sort of identity as an Asian person. So we all internalize that. And the way that we internalize it is going to be nuanced, right, based on where we internalize it, right, and from whom. So we think about, if we're starting individually, and we're thinking about that individual influence, that would mean potentially, right, that we're at home, maybe individually we're having interactions with our family. And a lot of what our family believes about identity, we're internalizing, we're taking it in, we're processing it, even at times when we don't realize that that's what we're doing, right? So like there's a sort of theory of like information. And it goes something along the lines of that we take in millions and millions and millions of bits of information, you know, per second, per minute. And that maybe at best, you know, based on these millions of things that we're taking in, we probably remember about 30, like consciously remember about 30 or 40 of these things that we're taking in. Right, but that doesn't mean that we're not processing that other information that's still coming into us, and that's still having an impact on the way that we, you know, navigate the world. So on that individual level, that would be like, right, those family, very familiar sort of relationships that we're making, but mostly would be that impact on the self. Interpersonally, that's going to include our family, but it's also going to include what happens when we go out into the world. So that could be the kind of relationships that we're making when we go to school for the first time, or the kind of friends that we make in our neighborhood, or the kind of people that we meet, you know, in a religious group, if our families are religious. So that interpersonal impact, right, is also going to impact us in one way. And then institutionally, that could be, right, the ways in which we're impacted or influenced by schools, the ways that we're impacted or influenced if we're like children growing up in a home with, and we have our parents or whoever our caregivers are, and let's say that those folks have jobs and they go to work, the ways in which our parents and our caregivers are impacted by the institution is also going to have an impact on us. So I can give an example. I remember once when I was, I think I was maybe like 7 or 8, and I've always been, I'm an Aries sun, Taurus rising, Capricorn moon. And I think, I forget where my Leo is, but it's somewhere in like the house that sort of is supposed to designate, or the house is supposed to designate like how you are at home. Is it 4th or 10th?
Yeah, I think it would be 4th.
So basically, you know, Leo 4th house, which can mean, right, that you can be very, very just like extroverted at home. And I am, I'm very silly, very loud, very like, you know, myself. And so for me, basically, I was sort of like the class clown, but only at home. And I did a lot of like joking around and making jokes and everything else. And that was like my sort of way of connecting with my family. So once I'm, you know, my mom works 2 jobs. She's a nurse. So she does a lot of like 12-hour shifts. And she basically, for all of my childhood, I know she did 2 things. And that was go to work and sleep. That are things that I actually saw her do. So, you know, she's working a lot to take care of us. And I remember her boss called, and her boss was like, oh, you know, I need to speak to, you know, Linda, whoever, so-and-so, immediately. And so I put my hand over the receiver and I say, you know, so that no one can hear. My mom says something like, I don't want to talk to her. So I jokingly say, but the receiver is closed. I jokingly say, you know, she doesn't want to talk to you. So my mom is horrified because she thinks that I have said to her boss that she doesn't want to talk to this person. And of course she's a black woman in like the late 90s, early 2000s, who's experiencing a lot of racism at work. So it's like one of those things where something like that, like a joke like that from a child won't be taken the way that it'll be taken if I was a white kid doing that. So this is like, I had never seen my mom so afraid. And I remember that even after she got off that call, she told me, she's like, please don't do that because that was just so scary for me. And I saw her be so afraid, you know, and me as a kid, not having a, of course, not like having a job at the time, not working at the time. And I won't say of course, because there's a lot of kids that we know that are put to work at very young ages. So I'll just say from my own sort of specific experience, I didn't have a job at the time, but that still had a huge impact on me, where for me, I learned from that the institution was something to be feared. That the institution was not something to be approached as like a whole person, you know, me being like myself, and that the institution was something, you know, sort of like in terms of like how you're sort of relating to it or interacting with it, that whatever it says goes, and that whatever it says that you need to be, right, to be employed by the institution, to receive support from that institution, needs to be what it is. And that had a major impact on me. And I think that, you know, the institution, I think oftentimes we don't really see it as having that big of an impact on us. We think that we leave our performance at work, but we don't. We bring that performance home and we bring it into our relationships, right? You go to work, somebody asks you how you're doing. You're dishonest, really, because you don't trust that person. And we know how in a lot of these work cultures, how trust is weaponized, how people will take very, like, you know, very nuanced details about our life and use them against us, especially if they're threatened by the fact that we're, you know, too Black, quote, unquote, too queer, too trans, right, too South Asian, too this, too that, too whatever they deem to be too much. That has a major impact on the way that we show up in our lives and in our relationships with people that we do have a lot of trust with and for. Mm.
Thank you for sharing all of that. Obviously, like, as you know, I think, you know, one big aspect, I think, of white supremacy is that many white folks, like, we are conditioned to trust in these institutions. Yeah. And because of that, it's, you know, culturally speaking, on like a larger level, there's a lot of white folks who just cannot see how institutions can be oppressive and perpetuate oppression because the institutions have been created to protect us, for the most part, protect us. I would say, like, unhoused, you know, white folks probably don't really trust, like, the police, for example. But for the most part, yeah, like, definitely. Thank you for sharing that really specific example, because I think, yeah, like, collectively, white folks, we really are needing to, all of us, deeply unlearn, like, the trust in the institution, because it's not safe for everyone. It's only safe for some.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And I think that even in that, for me, what comes up for me when I hear you say that, and I know we have limited time. Clearly, I'm a talker. I'll rein it in.
No worries. I love it.
But when I think about that, I think, you know, I think that's one of the misconceptions, is that the institution does protect white people. Mm-hmm. I think the institution protects white people's submissiveness. Mm. I think it protects a person's willingness to sort of give up their power in the name of doing what the institution thinks is best. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, in that scene, for example, if you've been a white person, right, even if you've been a person of color in an organization, you are beloved. People care about you. They seem to show up for you. They ask you how your dogs are doing, you know, or your guinea pigs in my case. You know, they show a lot of personal interest. And the moment that you say, you know what, I care about this organization so much that I'd like for us to do DEI work, suddenly a lot of those people or a lot of those folks in that organization who are expressing so much, like, care and consideration are treating you as if you've like betrayed them. Right. And so it's like, I think that also is a part of that mythology that we internalize, that is designed for us to internalize, is designed for us to really believe in, is that the institution is there to protect us, even for those of us who hold those dominant identities. Because the reality is that it's not there to protect us, right? Human resources is often more corporate resources than it is human resources. It's more so about protecting the institution and protecting that sort of, like, collective power so that it can be hoarded as much as possible, or even so that it can just be wielded to keep those who are most vulnerable out of positions of leadership and to keep those who are most vulnerable from having their voices heard.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, because your focus is so much on boundaries, yeah, there's so many, I feel like this conversation could just, like, expand in so many directions. Yeah. And I'm just wondering, and I feel like this is a conversation that needs to be happening with anyone that is invested in boundaries, because I think, yeah, there is some misunderstanding that I see around, like, what setting a boundary is, because a boundary is a compassion, you know, it's an act of love, it's an act of compassion, even if you're dealing, you know, with, a person or, like, an institution that's oppressive, putting up a boundary is, it's compassionate to the self and it's compassionate to everyone around you, in my opinion. So I really want to hear about, you know, cause I feel like you're very radical, like, your posts on Instagram, your shares are very, like, anti-capitalist, very, like, you know, critical of the state at large. And I'm curious, like, for you, why do you think it's important for, you know, especially for like Black trans folks such as yourself to be centered in conversations around boundaries?
I think because a lot of times we're taught specifically at the intersection of being Black and trans, being Black and gender non-binary, we're taught that even in our communities amongst each other, so if we're talking about Black queer community or Black trans community, I think oftentimes because we're so aware of one another's trauma, that a lot of times we sacrifice our boundaries. We become martyrs to the movement because we think, well, you know, I've been through a lot. This person's been through a lot. And yes, this person is harming me or continues to harm me, but, you know, fill in the blank. But there really is no but. There's no like, yes, we do experience a lot of harm. Yes, we've experienced a lot of trauma. That never makes it okay for people to harm one another. It never makes it okay for people not to accept accountability when they realize that they have caused harm. So I think in that way, I think that sometimes our boundaries with the institution and specific to that community, sometimes, not all the time, because, you know, people are different. There's a spectrum. But sometimes I think it feels like those boundaries seem to be a bit stronger than they are sometimes interpersonally. And the institution is not just, right, that's not just like a corporate entity. The institution are organized. It can be an organizing community, right? It can be an organization that is completely dedicated to Black lives, to honoring Black life, to protecting Black life, to bringing joy to Black life, where even in those spaces, right, a lot of times what happens is everyone has a default. And I think sometimes when we have a good intention, we think that we don't really need to sort of confront whatever our default setting is. But for a lot of us, being in community with other people where we're making decisions as a collective community, a lot of times our default is still that sort of capitalist function. But we're like, well, I'm working with this person in this movement, and I care about the people that I work with in this movement. And at the same time, if I'm working really hard, let's say I'm working 10 hours on a campaign every day, and there's somebody else who I'm working with who tells me, you know what, I can't work with you this week, I'm sick, or I can't work with you this week, I need a personal day, I'm not feeling well, or I can't work with you this week because I don't feel like I have the mental capacity, right? Am I trying to rail on that person? Am I saying, well, how dare you tell me that you don't have the capacity because I'm working 10 hours for our Black people, you know? I'm doing this and I'm doing this and I'm investing this way, right? And I think that a lot of times we can very quickly lean into that default sort of capitalist setting when it comes to developing those relationships with our communities. The institution inherently is not an evil thing. It's not inherently bad, right? Just like people are not, I can't just look at a person and know if a person is bad or not because they're a human being, right? I guess some people who are not very into human beings probably would say differently about that. But I can't just look at a person and say if they're bad or they're a good person, and I don't believe in binaries to that extent either. And the same with a collective, like an organizing body or like a movement or a campaign that's filled with people, right? I don't think that many of those things are inherently bad. And I think bad is also a very limited descriptor that doesn't really give us as much information as we need to be given when we're looking at something or critiquing something in particular. But I think that institutions that are not intentional about developing those foundational boundaries around not only their justice work, but also, I guess this would encompass everything. It's like their justice work, their movement work, how they're treating one another, how boundaries are to be honored with the institution and with other people, and how they're sort of really thinking about consent in very intentional ways, and having a strategy for when consent isn't honored.
I love all that. Yeah, I love everything you're sharing. And it makes me, you know, thank you for bringing up that dichotomy between good and bad and people being either good or bad, because that is kind of like a myth. And I think when you go back to that idea of in a meeting, you know, how a lot of white folks will just hearing about institutional racism, it creates a lot of fragility. And that's something I think that goes into that good and bad dichotomy, because and I've been there like throughout my life, you know, it's constant work. But I think like, you know, if you're in a position of privilege and you're listening to the stories or information even about oppression that has happened at the hands of an institution or an individual that benefits from the same privileges that you do, I mean, that's not a good feeling, but I think it's important to take the ego out of that and to just realize that this is work that we all need to do, instead of like getting defensive, getting being in fragility. And I think that good versus bad dichotomy is not helpful, because we all have capacity to cause harm, and then we all have the capacity to heal, I think. I mean, you know, there's like some capacity. Everyone has capacity to heal or to harm. And we wake up every day and we make that choice based on the resources and the tools that we have. So yeah, I think like we have to do away with all binaries and all dichotomies, because they aren't realistic. Like we're all, you know, there's bad parts of all of us and there's good parts.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And I think, like you said, it's just like it's a disservice to us. Mm-hmm. And I think that sometimes what ends up happening too is that we put people, even people that get put in that get good category, mm-hmm. You know, it's extremely limiting. And I think it really pulls and snags our humanity in ways that only bring about even, you know, that only perpetuate further harm for us and for other people. Mm-hmm. I think it's like with people pleasers. Like sometimes I hear people be like, oh yeah, I'm a people pleaser, you know? And it's like a badge of honor. Like I put all these other people before myself, and you know, everybody else gets what they need. If they're in my life, they're getting what they need, you know, but I put myself last, you know? And I think even though we don't say it, that there's still many of us who consider that to be a good trait, you know, mm-hmm. even if we're not seeing that like directly and openly. And I think, and I say that there's so many of us who consider it to be a good trait, because when we're on the receiving end of it, we don't disrupt it as often as we should be. There's been plenty of times where I have to take a friend aside and say, you know, I really care about you, and I thank you for being so supportive. Now take your ass home and go take care of yourself, you know, and make sure that you're getting what you need. Actually, how can I support you? And for the next time, few times that we talk, you cannot offer me anything, no support, mm-hmm. no this, no that. We're going to focus this conversation on you. We're going to center you. And that doesn't mean you have to share things you don't want to share, but it does mean that, you know, I have to disrupt that, because I know that that's oppressive. Whether you are trying to disrupt it as an individual or not, I know that that's not right. So I'm not going to be on the receiving end of that and just allow that to continue to happen, when I know that that's just not, it's not just in any way to you or to me.
Yeah, and that really, like what you just shared, makes me think again about what you brought up earlier about this level of, I think you said personal, interpersonal, and institutional. And yeah. When you were talking about that, I was really, I wanted to actually ask you a question about that. And I wanted to ask, like, do you think that those, like addressing boundaries and care and, yeah, I guess boundaries and care at those three levels, do you think that it has to start with the self and then it moves outwards?
You know what? That's a really good question. And it's something that I've thought about a lot personally. There's a part of me that wants to say yes, but then also there's a part of me that wants to say, not even like a certain no, but that wants to say that, you know, whenever we're setting boundaries, the self has to be attached to that. It has to be involved. Mm-hmm. Right? Just like with the three eyes, there's no way that you can extract one from the other. I think that anyone who's setting a boundary with self, anyone that's setting a boundary with other people, anyone that's setting a boundary with the institution, has to develop some sort of a foundation, some sort of a foundational belief that goes something along the lines of like, I am worthy or deserving of setting this boundary and getting what I need. And I think that across the board, if we don't have that, it's really difficult not only to just identify the boundary, it's really difficult to set it, and it's really difficult to hold to it if we're not caring or working on that sort of foundational belief that we're worthy. So I won't say necessarily that it you know, is starting with the self, because I find that sometimes we do things and it feels really unconscious, like we haven't even had the time to reflect, but we have a knee-jerk reaction, which a knee-jerk reaction sometimes is not always just like things that we regret. Sometimes a knee-jerk reaction is something where we're actually standing up for someone, or we're standing up for ourselves, and we don't even have the time to really reflect on the politic, right? Mm-hmm. Or the sort of like deep meaning of what it means for us to defend ourselves, or what it means for us to defend those who are most vulnerable in our communities. But we just do it. Right. And maybe that means that we're not necessarily starting with self in terms of if starting with self means some sort of a deep inward reflection, but we're starting somewhere. And that has to be what's most important. Right. And I really don't want to say starting with self or starting with, you know, the interpersonal relationship or starting with the institution, mm-hmm. because I'm also very wary of how quickly and easily people can fall into that sort of perfectionism.
Mm. Yeah.
Of like, give me the steps. You know, Mackenzie, give me the 5 steps, Bunny. And I'm just like, you know, there's not actually, it's not a rule, right? It's about building out a framework within which many people can work within that does not have like a set sort of like a guideline around we go from 1 step to 2 step to 3 step, but really is far more fluid because that's what life is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. It is. Yeah. Again, it is fluid. It is not a binary. So thank you for that. I was thinking about that because I come from a social work and like community-based nonprofit background before I became like a full-time witch. Yeah. And, I think that's like something that exists within those systems in that a lot of people want to sidestep the part of working on themselves, doing their own self-care work, healing their own traumas, because that part's hard, right? I mean, that's like hard work. So a lot of people want to sidestep that because it's difficult and go straight to the like community care thing. And that's really, you know, something I've been unpacking a lot. I think there's like, there's a lot of codependency in that. There's also saviorism in that. Mm-hmm. And that's dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Yes, for sure. I completely agree. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. If you're immersing yourself in the work, right, there has to be that foundational belief that's there.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like it's kind of like trying to plant a seed, and you don't really have anything to plant it in. So you put a seed in a cup and right, you're like, okay, well, I have the seed in this cup. And it's like, okay, that's good that you have a seed in a cup. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know when we get to that place that we start something, especially if we're starting in a place where like, I'm very consciously working on my internalization, right? Which I think most of us don't actually start there. I think we start with, I feel really uncomfortable and I feel there's some sort of a dissonance within me and I don't know what it is. But I know that I don't like it and I know that it's off, right? And that's where I'm starting. It's like, I feel a dissonance here, but I don't know what this is. But I think if we're not willing to sort of follow that dissonance, right? Just to develop an understanding of what it means for us to get what we need, what it means for our consent to be honored and for us to enthusiastically honor the consent of other people. Then I think we tend to repeat the same sort of lessons over and over again, and we refuse to learn anything new. We continue to do the same things. And then we show up in communities and we're like, you know, I am here, I am present, I am here to help. Like you mentioned, like saviorism happens, but we don't really grow and we don't make progress in our own sort of like justice work. And I think that's because we can't without developing those foundations. Like they need to be developed.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I also wanted to talk to you about, because yeah, everybody should that's listening, and it'll be in the show notes, all the information about how to connect with you. But people should definitely follow your Instagram because you have a lot of really great shares. And one thing that you've written a lot about and shared a lot about is how to write about gender. And I think, yeah, you had a piece on Medium about talking to your Uber driver and it was really good. So I was hoping you could share a little bit about why you started focusing your energy on that process and sharing it with others.
Sure. My background, the work that I've done the most is consulting specific to race equity and anti-racism. And I love that community. I love that space. And also there are a lot of folks in that space that don't know a lot about gender. And I think are very afraid to talk about it, to talk about gender and in a separate sort of a piece, right? Because we know that gender and sexual orientation are not the same, but I think also really afraid to talk about sexual orientation, right? So being in that space and seeing people who I love and admire, who are amazing and who are great at what they do, you know, talk to their clients and say, you know, you're going to be uncomfortable, but it is going to be okay. You're going to get through the discomfort of talking about race and racism and talking about the function of structural white supremacy and everything else. And then when it was sort of like when the sort of situation was reversed and it was time for them to be uncomfortable and talk about gender, I found that there was just so much trepidation.
Mm.
And I'm like, you know, of course there is, like, because we're human beings. When you go into that space as a facilitator and you say, hey, I'm inviting you to be uncomfortable, you know, and to embrace that discomfort, right? That's coming from a place of understanding what that's like, you know? So it's not like you leave your humanity at the door when you walk into a room and you're encouraging the people that you work with to sit in that space and to hold that space for you. So it's not like that comes as a surprise that there's a lot of race equity folks or folks in the sort of like anti-racism space that I think, unless they are a person who's in the community, the queer community, LGBTQ plus community, who's in the trans community, the non-binary community, then I think that it can be very uncomfortable. So I was encountering a lot of folks just like, I think, so afraid to misgender me that they wouldn't even use pronouns with me.
Mm.
And I thought, you know, now you're making me feel erased now. Yeah. And I know that you're feeling this discomfort, so I'm just going to start talking more so about this openly. I mean, it is not for nothing that I am an openly queer person. It is not for nothing that I am a gender non-binary person. That is very intentional. And in part, it's really intentional because I find in my community, for fear of losing work, for fear of losing income, for fear of not being able to take care of oneself, you know, because of what white supremacy has done to our communities and what white supremacy has done to us, there are a lot of Black folks who I think otherwise would be out, right? And there's plenty of folks who are not out, would never be out, and that's just like, that's totally fine, and that's just like how they, you know, navigate their lives, and I think that's a beautiful thing because it's your choice, your consent. But I'll say for those folks, so I think would otherwise be out, but the one sort of thing for them or bigger thing for them is that, I don't want to be public about my gender identity because I don't want to lose work. And mm-hmm. I know that I'm in a space where maybe these are folks who do care deeply about social justice, but are very eerie and cautious around gender and around trans folks specifically. So I'm gonna allow people to use these other pronouns with me that I actually don't like. And I'm going to allow people to use gender markers for me that are not my gender marker that make me cringe because I'm concerned about, you know, me being able to put food on my table.
Hmm.
So when I made that very intentional choice, I made it because I was like, you know, even if it does impact me being able to get work, and it does, I'll get folks that'll contact me when they realize that I'm non-binary. You're like, actually, you know, I don't know about this. You know, that has happened to me a number of times. So I knew that was a risk, but I really wanted people to be able to potentially who, you know, are interested in doing work that I do or who, you know, are currently doing work that I do to be able to maybe even just be encouraged of like, hey, even if that's not my choice, I'm not going to come out or I'm not going to be open about my gender markers and my gender identity because that's my choice. At least it's nice to know that I can look and see that there are other people who are publicly out and who are doing this work. You know, and that makes me feel, I don't know, maybe validated, maybe more accepted, maybe more, you know, maybe even more worthy of being visible and being loved as my whole self. So I did make that decision. And then when I was doing the work around or have been writing about gender and how to write about gender, it's because I really wanted to bridge those gaps. Because I know there are folks who sometimes will come to my page because they're like, I want to hear about the race. You know, I want to hear about the white supremacy. And it's like, great, you will hear about that. Or folks will come to my page and they're like, I want to hear about the capitalism. And it's like, okay, great, we can talk about that. Or I want to know about boundaries. I'm like, yes, we can do that. And also we're gonna talk about how a lot of this plays out in very practical ways when it comes to the ways in which we engage with the trans community. And the ways that we, you know, are accepting of those communities, the ways that we honor members of those communities, and the ways in which we're showing ourselves to be just as protective, if not more so, since these are more vulnerable communities, mm-hmm. just as protective, if not more so, just as caring and loving, if not more so. But I think a lot of times for people, it takes that invitation to exist within that discomfort. And I think sometimes it also takes people being able to, at least I like to do via my Instagram, I consider it or think about it sometimes as taking folks to the side and saying, hey, you know what? I have so much love for you. And also I'm going to share this with you because it's so important for you to understand the ways in which you are potentially perpetuating harm right now, maybe even in ways that you don't know, or maybe even in ways that you don't understand. But, you know, let's come together and actually have the conversation so you have a better understanding.
Mm-hmm. I'm so, like, you're amazing. I think you're so amazing because I think you're, you know, everything you're sharing right now, it seems like you're doing so much work for the collective. And I'm wondering how you are able to, because that sounds exhausting. Like everything you're saying sounds like a lot. And I'm wondering, like, how do you, I mean, it makes sense now why you would be so invested in boundaries. I'm curious, like, how do you make sure that you're sustained, that your cup is full so that you can continue to give so many offerings and so much to so many?
Yeah. I like people, really Black women. That's somebody else I was interviewed earlier for, a segment called, I think, Cradling Conversations or something like that. And they asked me a similar question. I said, Black women, I allow Black women to pour into me.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I, in turn, whenever I can, pour into them. You know, there was a Jujubee, who's on Instagram, hosted a panel discussion last week of Black spiritualists and priestesses and folks who are doing their work through an Afro sort of spiritual perspective, which is now, the replay is available now on YouTube for those folks who might want to look it up. And I watched that. I caught the tail end of it, first of all. And then I went back and was watching it some more. And it was just so inspiring for me. You know, I felt, even though I wasn't able to be there for the full thing, you know, when I went back and watched the replay, it still made me feel so validated, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be very honest, especially in my work, because I do a lot of work around anti-oppression, around social justice, I like to be very honest around how I'm feeling and how I'm doing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So when I decide that that's something that I'm consenting to sharing that and consenting to sharing that, those parts of myself. And when the lockdowns happened and I lost a lot of work, I probably lost, I want to say, around 25,000 worth of work in a few days.
Wow.
And these are things that I had been working on for several months, you know, where I was like, had been experiencing a lot of transphobia and a lot of like sort of internalized anti-Blackness. Because if it seems like if it's not one thing, it's another. And have been really working through that and building these relationships. And I've finally gotten to this place where I'm like, okay, now I'm doing this. I'm going to be presenting the keynote at the American Library Association. I'm going to be doing this, you know, really large workshop in Utah of all places. But hey, you know what? If y'all have me, I will show up. And mm-hmm. all these things on my calendar. And so they were canceled. So I found myself feeling really defeated, you know, feeling really defeated because it's like, damn, I'd implanted all these seeds. And I've been patient and I've waited for these things to come to fruition. And now they're not. And I felt really tired. But for me, what I found in sort of being in that space was really embracing that feeling where I'm like, you know what, I'm just not going to work. I'm not going to post. I'm going to lie down when I want to lie down. When I want to drink weed lemonade, I'm going to drink weed lemonade. When I want to watch my, you know, reality TV, my ratchet reality TV, I'm going to do that. I'm going to sleep when I need to sleep. And I'm going to give myself permission as best as I can to not worry about my financial position, to not worry about money, to just make sure that I'm fed and that I, you know, sleep when I need to and that I'm resting myself. Because my ancestors know that I have been working my ass off.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think both of those things, first of all, really embracing where I was as opposed to trying to continue to push. It's like, push, what am I pushing for? You know, if my body is saying rest and I need to rest. So allowing myself to really have that time to rest. And then allowing Black women who are doing programming, because it wasn't just Jujubee's panel, which again was so incredible, so brilliant, but also there's an organization here in Chicago called Affinity Community Services that focuses on offering support specifically to Black LGBTQ+ communities with a particular sort of centering of Black queer women.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing office hours. And so I caught the tail end of their, not the tail end, I caught the replay of their office hours. And at a time when I felt just really, really defeated, I found myself before I went to sleep at night, just replaying these office hours and listening to them until I went to sleep. are replaying another panel they did for Trans Day of Visibility, which was a panel of two just incredible and really brilliant Black trans women. One, Lasaya Wade, who's the founder of a nonprofit called Brave Place Alliance, which also is here in Chicago. And, you know, I found myself going to sleep with that. And then when I felt like I needed some more, then I would just, you know, rewind it and replay it again and just listen to it as I was going about my day, listen to it when I was going to sleep at night. And it made me feel so full, you know? Mm. It for me felt like I was really grounding myself in my calling and in my purpose in a way that was not centering what I felt like other people needed from me, but in a way that was really centering what I needed from myself. Mm. And that was great. And I think something that, of course, I'm human, times where I failed at it, where I haven't allowed people to sort of pour into me as I pour into them. And then times when I was receiving a lot of people's pours, but not contributing as much as I should have at the time. Mm-hmm. And now when I'm like, okay, well, I feel like it's all about finding the balance. There's always going to be times when we're doing a little bit more, a little bit less, right? Or we realize we're getting a little too close to the rails. So we're like, okay, let me just try to center myself out. But that's all a part of the ride as a whole. So I found that to be incredibly helpful, is like grounding myself in Black community, grounding myself in like communities specifically of Black trans people, of Black trans women, of Black trans non-binary people, of Black cis women, and getting that support.
Beautiful. That's so amazing. Thank you for sharing. And I wanted to say one thing that I thought of when you were speaking is when you were saying, you know, because obviously we're going through collectively and it affects all of us in different ways and some more than others, this pandemic that has caused like a lot of economic insecurity for many. When you were talking about all these seeds that you were planting, I feel like, and I'm sure you know this, like these seeds are still going to grow. They're just going to grow in a different way and on a different timeline mm-hmm. than we saw, you know, before this pandemic kind of began. So I think, yeah, you're still going to get to grow in all those ways.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I love that, claiming it.
Yeah. And I'm curious, you know, because I'm trying, you know, we are living in this time, and how do you feel like the current pandemic is affecting? I mean, you kind of already spoke to this, but how do you feel like your work kind of fits into the current pandemic that we're dealing with?
Oh my gosh, that's such a great question. That's such a great question. You know what? The honest truth is that I'm still figuring that out, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm still figuring that out. I think that, you know, I was saying this earlier too when I was being interviewed for something else. And I can't remember exactly what question the person asked me, but you know, I said somewhere in response or somewhere in between sort of like the questions that were being asked when we got to this place of talking about our place or our role or our purpose. And for me, as I was thinking through that, I thought, you know, there's this really, really incredible sort of like piece from Nayara Wahid from her book Salt. And it's a piece where she says, you know, I don't pay attention to the world ending because for me it has ended many times and begun again in the morning.
Mm.
And so as I was sort of thinking through that, I thought, you know, there's a lot of people in our world who have been having a lot of the same experiences that some folks are from more dominant groups are having for the first time.
Mm.
So having a government that is not invested in your well-being and care, not having access to healthcare, being sick and not having people believe you that you're actually sick and not paying attention to you, you know, having folks target you in the middle of the street just for being you, for being yourself. Mm-hmm. You don't know these people. You've never interacted with them before. Suddenly somebody is harassing you on the street and you're like, wait, what? Who are you? Mm-hmm. And that's been the lived experience for a lot of people for a very long time. So when I think about it sort of like in those terms, without discounting the fact that this is a very unique experience and like us experiencing the spread of COVID-19 during this time in 2020 is a very unique time, right? It's at an intersection that we would never experience again, because I don't believe that just those exact intersections we experience like at various times throughout our lives. So not to discount that, but I think that there's always going to be that place for anti-oppression work. I think there's always going to be that place for social justice work, and that in times of crisis, we are far more likely to perpetuate harms than we would be if there wasn't a time of crisis, right? Because there's a heightened sense of alert. There's a heightened sense of self-preservation, of collective preservation. And so I think that it's a really, really important time to ground ourselves in what our values are, to ground ourselves in what our principles are, and to think about not only what we need from the community, but also what we're seeking to contribute. And I think those things are important. So when I think about the place of my work, I'm like, okay, well, that for me sounds a lot like boundary work specifically. That for me sounds like, you know, continuing social justice education, continuing social justice awareness, and continuing to build these brave spaces of community where people can come together and really love each other, you know, and be embraced and be validated.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, that's beautiful. I feel like everything you say, I'm just like, amazing, beautiful, but it really is like you're sharing so much that is so rich and needed. And I've been like a fan of your work for a while now, but now I'm like a super fan because
oh my gosh, thank you so much.
So on that note, I would love to hear like a little bit about what your current offerings are and how folks that are listening can take advantage of those, invest in your work in some way, etc.
Sure. So, like I mentioned before, so I do anti-oppression consulting and coaching work. I do a lot of that work with businesses, like for-profit businesses, mostly nonprofit organizations. So if folks want to learn more about how to work with me, that route, then they can go to mckenziemack.com. And that's mckenziemack.com. And then I have boundary work, which is on a site of its own, because it grew a lot within the past year and a half. So I decided to separate it from my main offerings on the mckenziemack.com page. So if you'd like to learn more about boundary work, through which I also offer coaching work and trainings and workshops, which will now be mostly digital, then you can go to boundarywork.com and find out more about my work there.
Awesome. And I'll have the links to everything in the show notes, so folks that are listening can just click on the episode and find all the information there.
That sounds great.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having this conversation with me. I really appreciate it. Is there anything else you want to share before we end the call?
I guess maybe the last thing I want to share is just as a reminder is that in doing this work, we do not give up on each other. And we do not give up on ourselves.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Listening to the Rise Up Good Witch podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review in iTunes and check out www.riseupgoodwitch.com for more information about tarot readings and the apothecary.